My name is Heidi Michelson, and the title of this session is Stories of Salvadoran Life and Faith. I'm going to do several things this week, and one of the things is just to sit here and tell stories, because I think stories communicate sometimes in the best way different religious, spiritual experiences, and just what the life is like. A little bit about myself. I went to El Salvador for the first time in 1989, really on kind of a faith quest. Why did I go? I had heard a lot about the people in El Salvador and how they were, many of them, persecuted in the church for their faith, for their stand on justice, for their human rights, speaking out about human rights. And I heard about how people were being killed and captured, and I thought, boy, they're risking so much for their faith. I want to see what that's all about. I want to go there and see how they're able to do that and challenge myself and see, well, say, could I do that if that was required of me? So it was really to learn. And then I came back once in 1990 and once in 1991, and then for a longer period in 1992 to work with the Lutheran Church in El Salvador. So, just a couple stories. This is the second time I was down. This story is called Go to El Salvador to Get Your Dental Work Done. And my mom told me I should tell this one because it's great. In El Salvador, there was a war going on for 10 years, and a lot of the people had to flee the war area up to Honduras and out and so forth. And then in the late 80s, the people started to come back. You may have heard about the repopulations that were accompanied by U.S. church leaders. And the people, it was not safe to come back, really. But the people said, we don't care. We're tired of being refugees. We're tired of living in camps. We want to come back to our lands. And with the help of U.S. and international accompaniment, that means people who would stay there with them, we're just going to go back to our lands and create our community again and defy the government in that way, just by being in those areas. So I went up to one of these repopulations in 1990. No, I was 91. Anyways, to get there, we had to leave at 1 a.m. because it was dangerous to go up, and the army was not letting people through. We weren't allowed a safe conduct pass, so we just decided to say, well, we'll just go at night, and then when we pass the checkpoints, maybe the soldiers will be asleep. And that's what happened. We were stopped and at one bridge, and we put all the Salvadoran people we had up in front, and we had a story. We said we were going just to over the bridge and not any farther. We weren't going to go all the way up there. You always had to create a little lie, but you didn't call it a lie. You called it a story in order to do what you need to do. In fact, Bishop Gomez said once that one of the internationals, one of the foreigners who worked with the church, was really becoming Salvadoran because he no longer thought that it was a sin to lie. Because to save your life or to save somebody else's life, sometimes you had to tell a story. So anyways, we told a story about we were just going to go visit the nuns in some convent. But we put all of our Salvadoran people in front, and we had the story ready that we were going to say. And the internationals, we were supposed to be asleep in the back of the car. And a sleepy soldier looked in and sort of, you know, this is like 3 in the morning. It was a 9-to-5 army, paid well by the U.S. So, you know, when you're an army, you're a campesino, you're a young kid who really doesn't want to be making war anyways. These kids were kidnapped, basically, from their families and impressed into the military. They just weren't that motivated. And so he was, you know, kind of lucked in and, it's okay. You know, it's too much trouble to stop these people, even though we could have had arms that we were running. Or we did have food. We were bringing food up to the community. We didn't have arms. So we went up to this repopulation, and they were so glad to see us. They welcomed us with a... It was New Year's, and they had killed some animals. We saw these huge... they had killed two cows, and they were doing the butchering right out there, you know. So it was in our honor. They had killed the fatted calf, and we're having a big feast. And so we went around and saw all the different clinics and the school and so forth. And the last place we came to, it was about 7:30 at night, and it was the dental clinic. And the dentist was a man in his late 40s. Now, these communities were totally cut off and isolated from anywhere else, and they were peasant communities. They were made up of people who can barely read and write, who had always been very, very poor, and had always lived off the land, usually renting somebody else's land, like sharecroppers. So this man who showed us the dental clinic was a campesino. He was a peasant dentist. And we asked, well, you know, how do you get to be a dentist? He said, well, we had a training. A Brazilian dentist came and gave us a 10-week training. And he had, since then, he had trained 10 other people. And we said, well, 10 weeks, boy, that isn't very much. And he said, oh, but it was rough. Day and night we studied. And he was very proud of showing us, you know, he had all these charts up at the cuspid and the bicuspids, and he knew everything about dental work. And he showed us the most prized possession was this little box, you know, where the drill comes out and the thing to put water in and everything. They had not had the money to buy those. And so they got one, the Brazilian dentist got one for them. They took it apart and figured out how to make it for less than 10% of the cost it would have cost them. So with a lot of ingenuity, they had set up this whole dental clinic. They didn't have chairs, they just had like cots that you laid out on. So I'm with a group of four seminarians who all knew each other and were all quite chummy with each other. And at the end of his little talk on dental care and how to brush, and you know, he was telling us everything, I was having some dental pain. And I said, and my friend Susanna said, well, you know, at the end of the talk, we brought you a mouth, you know. And I said, yeah, you know. And his eyes just, oh, really? Oh, gosh, you know. So his eyes lit up, and he said, let me take a look. And I said, well, yeah, just take a look, and then I'll go back to Berkeley and get it done, you know. Just tell me what I have. And so I laid down on the cot, and he looked at me and told me, he said, you have three cavities, and one is pretty advanced. It would really be good to do that right now. In fact, I'll just go get some more tools, and I'll be right with you. And I said, that's okay. I'll just get it done back in Berkeley, right? And he was very, disappointed, or very, and he said, "Don't you want a souvenir from El Salvador?" No, kidding. He was very sad. I mean, offended, kind of, that I wouldn't trust him. So. I said, well, that's fine, I guess, go ahead. And the other people with me, they were, you know, crossing, doing last rites and, you know, all this stuff. And so I sat down on the thing, and they brought bottled water, so I had clean water that they put up on a shelf above with a tube so it would go right down. And he had the drill, used the drill, and he asked me if I wanted... Novocaine or something, and he had that. He said it costs extra, but and I said, "Well, do I really need it?" And he said, "No, not really. You can do it." So I decided not to go for the Novocaine. And he did my tooth, and I tell you, it was one of the best dentists I have ever had. Very, very neat and very fast, and just got that over with and so forth. And no big deal at all. And when we were done, they had a list of prices up there, you know, which were about, at that time, a filling cost about $1.50. And I asked him, of course, as a good North American wanting to pay my way, you know, I asked him afterwards, so how much do I owe you? And he said, nothing. It's the least I can do for your solidarity in coming here. And then it struck me, you know, I didn't have enough. I was a student at the time at the seminary, did not have dental insurance, did not have enough money to get that cavity filled. And here I am in a peasant poor community in El Salvador, and they've got free dental care. Or just about. $1.50 for them is still very cheap. They've got free dental care, and I don't. What is going on here? But we started talking some more after he said that, and turns out he had a son in New York who had fled during the early 80s, during the Depression. And he had heard from his son just once or twice and had not heard from him at all for about 2 years. And there was no mail service up in that community because it was very isolated and the war going on. So I asked him if he'd like to send a letter. And right there, then, he wrote a letter to his son, and he had an address, and I sent it for him. We sent it for him. So that was our exchange, that was our barter or whatever, a tooth for a letter. And it's always been one of the most beautiful memories in my mind of sharing, of solidarity. And I still get my teeth done with the same group. And I just got one done last year with a dentist who was about 17 years old, who did a great job too. And I took one of my, and that costs $1.50, I had to pay this time. And I took a number of my community members to the same, there are a couple dental clinics, they're called popular dental clinics, people's dentists. These kids are, you know, trained 10 weeks, day and night. You know. But they know, one good thing is they know what they can't do. And so I took one woman from my community and she had an abscess tooth and they took one look at it and said, we don't do this. Come back when our dentist, when our trained, you know, graduated dentist comes. So I want to throw that out to you. If you ever want to come to El Salvador, just come, you know, and bring your cavities with you. And you can pay for your flight. I mean, how much is a cavity these days? $150. Get three cavities done. And that would be most of your flight. So I'm serious. I'm serious. I have friends who are, you know, poor social justice activists who make sure they get all their dental work done while they're in El Salvador. I even had a guy who lost a tooth or chipped a tooth really badly when he was in El Salvador, and they did that too. They did a prosthesis for him. So the invitation is there. Come to El Salvador to get your dental work done. Let's see, how are we doing here? My next story is about a well that was built. It's actually about a whole process in a community. This is a process of development and so forth. First of all, this took place in an isolated community outside of San Jorge in the northeastern part of the country. And the pastor of this community was an older man about 75 or so years old, by the name of Don Napo. And his real name was Napoleon, but it also fit, you know, because he was a Napoleon, you know, he was just a real strong kind of character. You didn't cross Don Napo. You didn't mess with him because he could tell you right where to go. And so he was working in this poor community and started to think about development things. You know, it was it was a very isolated community too, and you started to say, get the people together and kind of say, well, what are the needs here? What does this community need in order to feel, in order to have a fuller life? And they got together, and it was mostly women, probably, because in El Salvador there are more women than men alive. So many men have gone off to war or gone in exile in other countries. And the women said, you know, we are really tired of carrying water on our heads in big plastic buckets 2 miles away in the river. We really need a well. So he was excited, and everybody got together on that. They were excited about that. And so they had to think about now where they were going to build this well, where were they going to dig the well. Now what they did was they asked all the older people in the community where they thought the well should be built, what should be dug. And the older people said, you know, there's this place, certain place in the community between, you know, I don't know what it was, a hillside or something. And, you know, our ancestors used to say that where you can feel kind of a little mist coming out of the ground, that's where there's water. And we have a place like that in our community. We have this little place by the hillside where you go by and you can feel a kind of mist. And so all the older people kind of decided that's where the ancestors used to say there was water. And that's where our well should be built. So they started digging. And they dug and they dug and they dug down by hand, you know, bringing up buckets of sand. And it was a very, very long process and no water. And they finally hit rock. It was very discouraging. Well, this is where the well is supposed to be, and we don't have any water there. Well, Don Napo was not the kind of guy who would give up. I really have learned a lot from the Salvadorans about persistence. You just don't give up. You just keep going. So he went back to the Lutheran Church in San Salvador, in the capital, to the Lutheran World Federation, where Phil Anderson was at that time, if any of you know him, and said, we've got this well project, and the people have already dug down, you know, 80 feet or whatever it is, and we need a little help to keep it going to find the water that's there. And so the Lutheran World Federation sent out geologists from Sweden and water hydrologists from Canada and other people from different countries that they had working. And they did maps and they, you know, spelled all out and they did it very scientifically, and they finally told the community, look, this is not the spot. We can't do it there. It has to be over here because there's an arroyo that comes together and really the water is going to be in another place. And the people looked at them and they said, well, that's very nice of you to come, but we've decided that this is our spot. That's what the ancestors said. So if you want to help us out with that, that's fine. If not, you just go and we'll continue what we're doing. Well, what, you know, the Lutheran World Federation people said, well, okay, I guess we'll go with what the people said. And they got out. They had to build a road into the community to get in this big drill. They had this massive drill like this. I saw it when I was there. Generator to power a drill. And they had to build a road to get in the generator and all the equipment. And they put it right on that spot and started drilling. And after just a little bit, hit wonderful, free flowing water. And the people all said, see, that's we knew there was water there. And then Salvadorans are very good about partying. And so they had a party. They had to bless this well, right? So they invited the Swedish water hydrologist to come back, and the people who had funded it, I think, were from the German Lutheran Church, and they hadn't even seen the project, but they had funded it, so they came, and the Canadians and the U.S. people, and everybody had a great party in front of this well, and they had a couple baptisms, of course, an affirmation of baptism, and everybody had a wonderful time, and they probably danced like crazy. I was there in this community a week after the party. I had missed the party. I wasn't there in the country yet. And say, this is the faucet. You know, the kid, I got into the community, and the kids would take my hand like this and say, and turn on the faucet and say, see, look at that, look at that, I got water. You know? They were so, it was just the biggest thing that had ever happened in these people's life. Look at this. I mean, it was so exciting. They were just pulling us from all around. So that's my one of my stories for persistence that helps me think about how the maybe stubbornness too. they had their spot, but these people. It took 3 years from the time of the beginning of their thinking about it to the time that they got the water was 3 years, and that's a long time to wait for water. They kept doing it. One of the things that I've learned about, it's been very interesting the last year, has been this indigenous culture. Like I talked about, the ancestors said that there's water at a certain point. And there's more and more that I'm learning about that. One of the things is that one of the members of the community that I serve, which is a shanty town on the outside of the capital, one of these people is an older, well, no, she's not old, really, she's probably in her late 40s. Her mother's in her 80s, who is an indigenous healer. That means she people come to her and she heals them with herbs and prayers and a lot of stuff. And I remember one time I was really flabbergasted. I had no idea that any of this was going on in my community. And then suddenly I was just talking to her, and a kid came in, a mother came in with a baby. And she started to diagnose the baby, and the mother said, you know, I've tried going to the doctor, I went to the local clinic, and nothing worked. And she said, oh, it must be evil eye. It must be evil eye. Well, that's okay. I'll just do the process. So what she does is she puts the kid in a hammock about up here and takes an egg. Now, this is it has to be an egg from a happy chicken. This is not a store-bought egg. This isn't, you know, a chicken that's been running around and having a good time, free-range chicken. You take an egg. They call it a wild egg. And you put it in a glass, and you put it underneath the kid's hammock, and then you say a lot of prayers and so forth. And the evil that has been done to that child from somebody who may have been jealous and sort of, what happens is, they say, somebody who maybe is admiring the child or something is kind of jealous of that child's beauty or whatever, can give that person evil eye, can give the child evil eye. Now, it's broken if you touch the kid, so I always make sure that when I admire kids, I go up and touch them, too, so they don't think I'm giving evil eye, you know? Anyways, so they put them in the hammock, and the evil all comes down into this egg.
Is the egg broken, or is it?
Well, then you wait 20 minutes, and then you bring it up, and she'll look at it and say, see how the yolk is going up? That was done by a man, that evil eye. Or see how the yolk is down? Or I don't remember exactly how it is. That was done by a woman, see, obviously. And 9 times out of 10, it works. It works. So, you know, they do both. She's very good. I'm glad to say that she does not see the medical establishment as enemy, or people who she can't treat, she sends them somewhere else, to a medical clinic or something. And if the kid had continued to get worse, they would have taken him to the hospital downtown, the Children's Hospital. So I figure, well, you know, it does a lot to calm the parents' nerves. A calmer parent is going to have a good effect on the kid. I don't know what's going on. They also sometimes rub the child's body with an egg, and that's supposed to do something too. So there's all kinds of interesting healings. A lot of them are really with herbs. Different herbs, and there's one Lutheran church that has a couple of Lutheran churches that have botanical gardens, and they make their own medicines. And one time I was at this one church, and that's just the same thing, like, oh, you have a problem with your tooth, you know, we'll help you. And I had a bad cold, and so the pastor said, here, we've got a salve, and it was just like Vicks Vapor Rub that they'd made out of eucalyptus, and they made their own medicine. So a lot of it is really legitimate medicine that really helps, you know. It's cheaper, though. It's about, you know, maybe 1% of the cost that they'd be able to go and buy Vicks Vapor Rub for. Mari, this woman who is the natural healer, happens to be from a very special family in the community. And that is because her brother was martyred there in the community. He was a Catholic catechist during the early 80s. He worked with Oscar Romero somewhat. And during the early 80s, just to be a member of the Catholic or the Lutheran Church was a subversive thing and was dangerous because the church was speaking out against the human rights abuses, and so the military and the government lashed back at the church. So he was martyred right there in the community in October of 82. And every year now we celebrate that event in the community. And they tell stories about him, about how he knew his death was coming, and he knew he was going to die, and he told his mother, "Mother, don't cry for me. Just like the Virgin Mary is going to suffer, unfortunately, you're going to have to suffer that too. But I will rise again." And the Salvadoran people really had to live out that martyrdom and it was an incredible thing, and it's still going on somewhat. You heard someone talk this morning about the Jesuits at the Jesuit University. They were, of course, as Jesuits throughout the world, very, very educated. And they put all of their education at the service of justice. So they were speaking out against human rights abuses. They were looking at the economic systems and land distribution in El Salvador. And if you go into the Jesuit University, say you've got the altar at the front here, and the back, against the back windows, are these huge drawings, Stations of the Cross, of people in various grotesque body positions, like people were often found during the 80s killed on the side of the street. And so they're people with marks of torture on their bodies and everything, dead, you know? And they're just twisted and mangled bodies. And I always think of this, that every day, they have daily mass, every day as these guys celebrated mass, they looked out and saw these and knew perfectly well that one day they would end up like that. And they were given death threats repeatedly. And they left the country once in 79 for a while, most of them left in exile, but then they came back later. And it just astounds me how they kept going in the face of that. When they were killed, that was November 16th, 1989, they the army came in at 2 o'clock, something like that, and had to bomb the doors open. It was just terrible destruction, just firepower all over. They just took their machine guns and basically destroyed the whole place where they were staying. And they dragged them out and shot their brains out at point blank range. And as they were being dragged out, I think it was Ignacio Ellacuría, he was the rector, and he was a liberation theologian, very well-known writer. As they dragged his body out, it banged against a bookshelf, and a book came out and got his blood on it. And when people went back later to look and to clean up the mess, they noticed that the book, the title of the book, it was Jürgen Moltmann's The Crucified God. And the Salvadorans, of course, none of this symbolism is lost on them. None of this symbolism. They very much connect that martyrdom with Jesus' death and resurrection and celebrate that every year and remember every year, every November and every March when Oscar Romero was killed. We have special celebrations of remembering the people's commitment and risking their lives, and then of repeating every time their names are repeated, the names of the martyrs are repeated, and everybody shouts presente. They're here, they're present. And it's a sense of people believing in the resurrection here in the community. Here, people are present with us, resurrected again here among us. As Oscar Romero said, if they kill me, I will die. If they kill me, I will rise again in the Salvadoran people. And the people continue to make that happen in the way they remember and the way they live. I'm going to go back to, I forgot the one about, this goes. The community where I work is a shanty town, basically. People have moved there because their areas of the country got in conflict during the war. They've set up shacks made out of sheet metal or mud or bamboo or cardboard, or anything else they can find. And most of the people live by trying to sell things on the street. Some of them are day laborers. Some of the women work in homes as domestic servants and so forth. And one of the women, one of the families in the community was Elsa and her husband Santiago. They are the poorest, they were the poorest family in the community, and have 9 children. Actually, I think she had 11, but 2 died. And Elsa was just always working. She has a basket on her head all the time and was always selling vegetables in the street. She'd go to the market really early in the morning, like 4 in the morning, and the market people would give her the vegetables that were kind of damaged from the day before. And she'd take a knife and kind of cut out all the damaged parts and put them in new bags and sell them. So that's what her work was. And her daughter, who's her 13-year-old daughter, Roxana, always went with her and sold vegetables. Well, Elsa got very sick in March. And she didn't go to the doctor because she didn't have enough money. And what the healer could do for her was not working. Actually, Doña Mari, the healer, told her to go to the hospital because it was serious. And finally, people pressed her and said, really, you've got to go to the hospital. And she was always saying, oh, but who will take care of my children? You know. But they took her late, but they finally got her to the hospital and did surgery on, I think it was gallstones, but it was so bad, it was like abscessed already. And she was in the hospital a couple days, and then she came out and still was trying to take care of her children and was not resting like she should. And I wish I had been around more. I think I had to do my other job during this time and was just not present that much in the community at this time. She wasn't getting the rest that she should have. And after a couple days of being home, had to be taken back to the hospital. And then she died in the hospital Easter week. No, Holy Week. During Holy Week. It was like Monday of Holy Week or something. The community laid her out right in her home, which is usually what's done. The wake is done right there in the community. The family prepares the body. And this family has kind of had a marginal contact with the Lutheran Church. They're basically Catholic with deep love and respect for what the Lutheran Church has done in the community. So they didn't have a priest because they're too poor to really pay for anybody to do a whole service. I think you have to pay for a whole funeral mass and so forth. So they had they ask a holy woman who's called a prayer, a rezadora, to come and lead the prayers, to lead the rosary and so forth. So they put these pictures of Mary up on the top of the casket, and we're doing all the whole rosary, and all the prayers were to Mary. It was very interesting.
Were you
there? Yeah, I was there. And then one interesting practice that I noticed was they put a glass of water next to the casket. I said, what's the glass of water for? And they said, well, that's for the soul. You know, the soul, for 40 days after the death, the soul wanders around in wherever, purgatory, I suppose, and gets thirsty during that wandering. So we put the glass of water out for the soul to drink. You know, souls really do drink. And I said, oh, well, that's interesting. Now, next door neighbor was an evangelical. His name is Cruz. And he's very anti-Catholic. Okay, the evangelicals there are just saying, all of this is total bullshit. You have to stop doing everything. Everything is bad. Get us sick. So he came in next to pay his respects. And he said, this glass of water's got to go. That's full. That's totally wrong. And Doña Mari, who was the healer, kind of said, well, you know, this was Elsa's belief, and she would have wanted a glass of water. And I know she appreciates that right now. Look, when you die, we won't do this. We won't give you a glass of water. You'll be wandering around up there real thirsty, but we won't give you water. Well, I learned more about the beliefs, and the beliefs are partly probably indigenous beliefs about the soul and mixed together with Catholic stuff. So I was invited to say a few words, and I, as a good Lutheran, I preached the resurrection. I preached about her being in God's hands at that time. And nobody seemed to think that was much of a conflict. It's just, there's a great capacity for sort of bringing everything in and mixing it up together, you know. And then we started talking about what are we going to do with the kids. 9 kids. Her husband's an alcoholic who works sometimes and drinks most of his wages. So what are we going to do? The rest of the neighbors, actually the rest of his family wanted to each take 3 kids or something. And he said, absolutely not, I'm the father, they're not taking my children from me. Well, Latino families tend to be very big on family, and they kind of respected that. But the neighbors were very concerned that he would not take care of the kids and would drink and maybe even abuse them or something. And so the neighbors, Doña Maria and Doña Cleo and Cruz and the others, kind of got together and said, okay, we'll let you leave, you know, have the kids for now, but we hear one word of abuse or mistreatment and we're calling the authorities immediately and they're out of there. And then the church and the community, I say, it's really one thing, you know, church, community, village, it's all together. Talked a lot about what we should do, and we decided that we would take over the responsibility for these kids. That means that as a church community, we're paying for the children's education. They didn't go to school. Just this year, they've gone to school with scholarships from the church. And individual families are looking out for the kids and feeding them. That's the neighbors right around. Now, they're not going to feed the father. If he, you know, they give kids food at neighbors' houses, but they don't bring a whole lot of food over to the house so that he can just kind of live off of that. So they're not trying to walk that fine line between enabling an alcoholic and taking care of the kids. But I was really touched with the neighbor's commitment to this family and their willingness to share their bread and just do that, take responsibility. They just said that's what we're supposed to do without, you know, sure, we could have read the scriptures and sort of beat that into them, but that was not necessary. They just took it over and did it. So my last story has to do with generosity. And that's generosity and hospitality. And those are some of the things that I think are most special about the Salvadoran people and are most things that I'm trying to learn from them. And this, you've already heard this story. You should have been at the beginning. You can listen to the tape when I told the stories you haven't heard yet. But this story is called Francisco's Pigeon Mite. Pigeon Mite. Last year, my community was building a church. We needed a place to worship and decided to build a church out of bamboo and so forth. And so we went up to the mountains to cut bamboo. And I got a four-wheel drive truck, and six of us from the church council went up to cut bamboo for the church. Now, we didn't have enough money to go eat at a restaurant. We stayed over at a friend's house. We didn't have enough money to eat, and the friend was not there. It was just an empty house. So everybody decided to bring something, you know, good old potluck. And oh, shoot, I forgot to explain Francisco. Hate it when that happens. Okay, first I have to talk about Francisco. Francisco is a guy in his 30s, 36 maybe, who is a little bit off. I would say he's mildly retarded maybe. Probably out of malnutrition. Probably didn't get enough food to his brain when he was growing up. He's from an extremely poor family. His mother's a little that way too. Just not real bright. But he's not retarded enough to really, you know, be too noticeable. He just a little bit. So he was our building and grounds person. And while we were in this whole building process, he volunteered that we could use his house to store the building materials, all the lumber and all the tools and so forth. Now, the only problem is that Francisco had some pets. He had pet pigeons. Really, some little baby ones and cute ones. Well, you know what happens with pigeons. They tend to leave a little gift on things. So we had this beautiful lumber laid out, and they would leave their droppings on that, and it was just getting to be a real mess. And I kept on saying, Francisco, can't, you know, I thought the pigeons were just pests. Can't you do something with these pigeons? Just get them out and, you know, just don't let them do that to the wood anymore. Just put them somewhere else. And he would just kind of smile, you know. And I never got, you know, what is this with the pigeons? I mean, I just never got it. He'd just kind of smile. And the next week, the lumber would still be all shit on, you know. So we go up to this mountain retreat and everybody brought something. And I brought cheese, and somebody else brought coffee, somebody else brought tortillas, somebody else brought rice. And Francisco brought this soup. I thought, wow, you know, I've never seen him eat anything but tortillas and beans. And he brought this great soup to the church potluck. And I thought, wow, Francisco, that's really great. I didn't even know you could cook. And he smiled and was really proud of it. So we're eating. And I'm eating my soup. And I pick up this piece of meat. And I said, you know, this is chicken, right? Yeah, where did you ever get a chicken? And he just kind of smiled at me, you know. I said, I know, your neighbor Daisy probably gave you a chicken. That was her contribution, right? And he just kind of smiled. And then I said, you know, this chicken's a little small, but it's good. It's great. It's really, it's small but tasty, you know. And everybody else just kind of smiled at me. And then when I was done, it finally came to me and I said, That isn't chicken, is it? That's one of your pigeons, isn't it? And he smiled at me and said, yeah. And everybody just kind of, you know, the joke was on me. And I got, you know, within myself, I thought a little, God, these are really dirty pigeons. And who knows what diseases they might have. Probably have mites all over them or something. And you didn't tell me it was pigeon, you know. And Francisco, at that point, smiled, and he said, yeah, I eat one of them every month. And then it occurred to me that he gave up his only meat for the whole month. That the only meat that he eats every month is one pigeon. And he decided to give that up for the church potluck. And that was his tithe, his contribution to our gathering. And it just astounded me. I thought, wow. And then I could finally say, wow, Francisco, thank you for that pigeon. That was a wonderful soup. And I thank you for giving me your meat. And they gave me the biggest piece, of course. So that, ever since, my dad's stewardship chairman at our church, and he wrote that up as a story in the church newsletter for about stewardship, because that, to me, really says a lot about giving, about stewardship. Just astounds me, and these experiences happen all the time when people just give over and above. So, that's it. Thank you.
How long have you been down
there? 3 years now. I first went in 89, but I had to leave. So I came back again for good in 1992.
Tell them why you had to leave.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. Someday I'll, maybe when, in one of the other sessions I'll talk a little about that. I had to leave in 89 because I was arrested by the military. And I spent a couple days as a guest of the Salvadoran Treasury Police. And actually just a day. And it was one of the most stressful, one of the most intense experiences, and one of the experiences of greatest faith and closeness to God.